Welcome back to the MLB.com StatCast podcast. I'm your host, Mike Petriello. Joining me here is MLB.com national editor, Matt Myers. And as we're taping this, we've watched two, I think, really exciting wildcard games, and we're looking ahead to the division series. So that's what we're going to do on the show. We are going to check out some pretty interesting StatCast moments from Yankees, Twins, and Diamondback Rockies, and look ahead to some of the division series. Have you enjoyed the two wildcard games so far? I mean, they've been pretty exciting.
They've been bananas.
They've been awesome. I'm completely in favor of keeping the one-game format forever. I know it's not, quote-unquote, like, the right way to decide a winner, and I don't even care. These have been, like, really fascinating games to watch.
Totally. Great, great baseball. A lot of just, like, interesting subplots. It's been a blast. If the rest of October is like this, it's going to be a great October.
It's going to be fantastic. I do think we have to make one point, though. Everybody's talking about bullpenning, which we've talked about on the show as well. And while, like, the four wildcard starters have combined to throw 7 1/3 innings, which is insane. That's not really bullpenning if your starting pitcher is getting lit up and you just get, you know, gets one out like Luis Severino does. Bullpenning is if, like, I don't know, Josh Tomlin is scoreless through 4 1/3 and you take him out because you don't like the odds after that, right? This isn't that.
Yeah, also, and the other thing is, like, the Yankees is the only bullpen that's pitched well.
Right.
Their bullpen has gotten shelled. So this actually isn't necessarily been a great advertisement for bullpenning. And now in the next couple of days, we're going to see a lot of really good starting pitchers. We'll get to that more in a second, but I think maybe first we can go over the wild card games in a little more detail.
Yeah, I mean, let's quickly look back at Yankees Twins, which was a pretty fun game. I mean, Severino getting blown up in the first inning was not what anybody expected. The Yankees, as you said, the Yankees were the only, like, really good bullpen we've seen. The Yankees had the 60 hardest thrown pitches in that game. They averaged 97.1 miles an hour on their fastball. The Twins did not have a single pitch that was thrown harder than 97 miles an hour even. Maybe that's more about the Twins than the Yankees. I guess it says a little bit about both. But I found that to be really interesting. There were four different Yankees, Severino, Chapman, Conley, and Green, who all threw harder than any Twins pitcher did.
Yeah, I mean, the Yankees bullpen right now, with that, the velocity they have coming out of there, they're once they got through that game, they're well equipped. This Indian series is going to be fascinating.
And do you remember where Chapman had a brief, like, slump kind of midway through the season? That seems over with now. His final pitch of the game, 103.7 miles an hour. It was the fastest of the StatCast postseason era. Let's just take a listen to that really quickly.
Here's the 0-2 to Polanco. Struck him out swinging. Ball game over. Yankees win. The Yankees win.
So Chapman owns the 58 hardest pitches that we've tracked in October over the last three seasons. He has 98 of the top 100. The other two are from Noah Syndergaard 2 years ago. It's not surprising. Like, we have a Chapman filter on our website. But I still think it's just really interesting the way velocity has increased in the game. He is still, you know, quote unquote, the man in that department.
Yeah, and he seems to, like, the fact that he sort of rebounded, sort of just the Yankees bullpen looked maybe a little vulnerable when he looked a little vulnerable, you know, in August, but now that he looks like Chapman again, the Yankees bullpen is, well, it's formidable.
And that's if Dellin Betances, like, looks like Dellin Betances again, too. He didn't even pitch in this game. I think the hero of this game was probably David Robertson, who came in. He threw 52 pitches, and I found this really interesting. 34 of those pitches, that's 65%, were curveballs. And when I saw that at first, I had to go look. I'm like, is that possibly right? That's a lot of curveballs. The 65% curveballs is the second highest of any reliever who threw 25 total pitches in a game this year. And I think the top four on this list is pretty interesting because they're both about to face off. Cody Allen of Cleveland threw 72% in a game in June, and then Robertson, and then Cody Allen threw a game 62%, and then Robertson back with the White Sox 61%. So these are two guys who don't exactly, like, they can throw hard, sure, but they've got a lot of bendy pitches too that really come out.
Yeah, and it was interesting. It's what I found interesting was Robertson's career high in innings pitched, which I think was, I can't remember if it was 3 3 1/3, but his previous high was 2 1/3 innings 3 weeks ago, which surprised me, in September too. Like, for David Robertson with expanded rosters, it was on September 11th against the Rays in one of those games at Citi Field. But, like, for him to throw his career high in innings in a September roster game, a little bit odd, but still amazing performance. He's the hero of that game for the Yankees.
I can honestly say I have no recollection of that September game you're talking about, so maybe I was on vacation. It's interesting. Robertson threw 42% curves with the White Sox, 49% with the Yankees, and the Yankees are kind of at the forefront now of the, I don't know, are we calling it the curveball revolution? I guess that's what it kind of feels like with them. And, you know, he's a great example of that. So we'll get back to the Yankees in a second because they are moving on to face Cleveland. But first, the wild card game in the National League, that got off to a really interesting start because John Gray did not look like he was going to have it. And, you know, he didn't, but it ended up being kind of a wild game. Diamondbacks 11, Rockies 8, which I guess is exactly the outcome you would expect between these two teams in one of those parks.
Yeah, it also proved my theory that Chase Field produces the most entertaining type of baseball. I think you get the widest variety of types of games at Chase Field because it's like it's not quite as extreme as Coors Field where like every game feels like a slugfest, but it has slugfest possibilities. It gets you homers. It does also get you triples. Chase Field to me is the most fun place to watch. You're gonna get the you're most likely to get a wide variety of outcomes at Chase Field,
especially with Rodney closing out the game for you because he's always a blast to watch. The Diamondbacks had 4 triples last night. The postseason record is 5, done twice by the 1903. I don't even know if they were the Red Sox at that point. The Americans,
I think they were the Americans.
Yeah, so it's been a while, is the point. And so 4 triples last night in one game, and this goes to one of your favorite fun facts of the year. The Blue Jays had 5 triples this entire season, which is amazing. And the Diamondbacks had 4 just last night. They weren't just like any kind of triple. They were really interesting triples, you know. Kendall Marte had 2 triples, 11.1 seconds from home to third, and then 11.2 seconds from home to third. One of those was the second fastest in the 3 years we've ever tracked for the Diamondbacks. And then the second one, the 11.26, was the second fastest of the year for Arizona. So he basically was the fastest home to third guy for Arizona this year and also for the last couple of years. And then Archie Bradley. Now, we're going to talk about a pitcher tripling. Here's your opportunity. You get it out of the way.
Well, speaking of those, you mentioned before the Blue Jays had 5 triples all year. As I noted on Twitter on Sunday, Luis Perdomo hit his 4th triple of the year. So Luis Perdomo had 4 triples this year. The Blue Jays had 5. That was my favorite stat of the year. But Luis Perdomo, the pitcher king of triples, but Archie Bradley entered his way into the conversation with the first ever relief pitcher triple in postseason history.
This may be where we all need to talk about, you know, process versus outcome for a second, because everybody was really, really confused that Archie Bradley was hitting in that situation, right?
It was a weird managerial, because he came in with 2 outs in the previous inning, so it was an obvious double switch situation when he was clearly could have come up in the 8th.
So he ended up letting Jeff Mathis, who's not a strong hitter, and then the pitcher hitting back-to-back, and they had 3 catchers. You know, it's not like there could have been a double switch situation. You could have just pinch hit for Mathis. And it worked out, clearly. It just, I don't know, it was very confusing how we got to that point.
It was also, I mean, Archie Bradley, a star quarterback in high school, so obviously a great athlete. So to me, before I even looked at his career hitting line, I was like, well, you know, he looks like he has an idea of what he's doing at the plate, and it wouldn't shock me if he's a pretty good hitter because he's a great athlete. You know, he was a recruit to play football at Oklahoma. So only after his triple did I go in and look up 6-for-61 in his career as a batter. He used to be a starter, so he actually had some at-bats. 6-for-61 with 0 extra base hits. This was his first extra base hit at the major league level.
Did you hear how loud that place got? Let's take a minute. Let's listen to what this thing sounded like.
Runners take their leads at first and second. Fly ball. Left center field. That ball's going to be in the gap. Archie Bradley, are you kidding me? He's going for third, and he's in with a slide. It can only happen in the wild card game.
An 0-98 hitter. Career. Archie Bradley gets a slider from Neshek and splits the gap. And look at the hustle by Bradley.
So Archie Bradley, I mean, is he going to hit again the next time around?
Perhaps my favorite thing about his triple, and not just his scream when he got to third base, was his smooth pop-up slide. He looked like someone who has done this before. Like, you almost feel like Archie Bradley in his spare time is practicing, like, you know, I'm going to get this moment. Because all the time you see, like, experienced position players botch pop-up slides and come off the base and get, like, tagged. He had, like, the smoothest pop-up slide I think I've ever seen. So Archie Bradley, very impressive.
There were 7 pitcher triples this year. That's the 8th. Luis Perdomo had 4 of them. Somehow Jeremy Hellickson had 1 when I looked this up. I don't remember that happening. Jake Arrieta had 1, I believe.
But I want to bring up the final triple of the night for the D-backs, which was A.J. Pollock, which it was an 8-7 game. And what was interesting to me, what set up A.J. Pollock's triple, because with 1 out in the bottom of the 8th, J.D. Martinez came up and he hit a ball deep in the hole. And when he hit it, I was like, oh, the double play, end of the inning. And Trevor Story turned it pretty quickly. It wasn't hit that hard, so there was a chance. Trevor Story turned it, flipped to second, LeMahieu throws to first, and J.D. Martinez beat it easily. And I was really surprised because I don't think of J.D. Martinez as being that fast. And I looked it up. Sure enough, 4.21 seconds to first base, his fastest home to first time of 2017. Previous best was 4.28. He had a sprint speed of 28.6 feet per second on the play. His season average on max effort sprint speed was 26.8 feet per second.
So slightly below average. Major league average is 27 feet.
So he, I mean, it just cools. It just goes to show, it's a way we can quantify like adrenaline of the postseason, that these guys, they find the extra gear. Like, we can now show you exactly that he finds, after this long season, eighth inning of a playoff game, he runs as fast as he's run all season to keep out of the double play. Jake Lamb follows that up with a single. Pollock hits a triple to make it 10-8. Jeff Mathis gets a bunt single to make it 10-7. Jeff Mathis bunt single makes 11-7. And if you're a Diamondbacks fan or a Diamondbacks player, 11-7 with Fernando Rodney coming in is feeling a lot more comfortable than 8-7. And if he gave up a run, and the D-backs won 11-8. That was my favorite moment of the game, was seeing JD Martinez just being able to quantify that extra gear that he found in that moment.
I'm glad you brought that up, because Charlie Blackman did a very similar thing. Charlie Blackman laid down a bunt. The Rockies were down 6-4 in the top of the seventh, one out. Luke Jorge was on third. And, you know, usually I'm very anti-bunt, but this was, I thought, was a good bunt, because it wasn't a sacrifice. Like, the goal was not to give himself up. And he got the run home. But what I thought was interesting about this, 3.61 home to first. That was his fastest time of the year. It was actually the fastest time we've ever tracked by a Rocky. Right. So that's exactly, it goes to what you're saying. I heard some complaints on Twitter. You know, he's an MVP candidate. Why is he bunting? Well, he's a different player on the road versus a lefty, right? Versus lefties on the road, his weighted on base average is 315. League average, basically. Now compare that to what he is at home versus righties, 5'11". He is a completely different player, like, in different situations. You can't just assume it's one size fits all for these guys.
Yeah, I mean, Blackman was sort of the home-road dynamic was probably most at play, I think, for him last night in that game, because, like, he didn't really do anything. I mean, that was his biggest contribution, was that bunt. And he did not really hit the ball hard, did not look that great at the plate.
All right, well, the wildcard games were a blast. Let's look ahead to some of the division series. Before we move on, I want to take a minute to tell you about the MLB Pipeline podcast, which focuses on all things draft and prospect related. MLB Pipeline's draft and prospect gurus Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo join Tim McMaster each week to talk about what's going on in the universe of MLB's future stars. Last week, Jim and Jonathan drafted rookies they think will have the biggest impact this postseason, and then looked back at their preseason playoff predictions before debating updated World Series picks. To hear all that and more, search for MLB Pipeline in Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from, and click subscribe. And speaking of preseason predictions, I think you and I both have our World Series teams active, right? I thought it was going to be Cubs over Astros.
And I had Dodgers over Astros.
All right, so we're alive. We're both still alive there.
I mean, this is the eight best. I think it's hard to argue the eight best teams are left, and that's great.
These are four really, really exciting series. So let's start with the ALDS, Cleveland and the Yankees. And there's a couple of interesting things happening here, and I think most notably the rotations, probably on both sides. I was a little surprised to see that Severino is not going to start until potentially game four for the Yankees. I mean, obviously didn't throw that many pitches the other night. I didn't think he'd come back for game one, but they've announced Sonny Gray first, Sabathia second, Tanaka third, Severino fourth. And I'm surprised by that. Severino is probably still their best pitcher, that terrible wildcard game aside.
Well, I think there's two factors at play here, one of which is Tanaka has been a different pitcher home and on the road. So I could see why they wanted to hold him back for game three to pitch at home. It's like, I wish I'd looked the numbers up for the game, but trust me, before the podcast.
It is true.
It's night and day. So it's pretty clear to me that they wanted to ideally have Tanaka pitch at home, and they have that. Now, the question would have been, otherwise, if you assume that, then it's okay, you're going to bring Severino back in game three, which would have been basically, in game two on Friday, which basically would have been 2 days rest. Granted, he only threw like 25 pitches on Tuesday, so you could argue that like it was almost like a glorified throw day for him. But Severino is in way uncharted territory for innings pitched in his career. He had 193 regular season innings. I think he ever gone much past like, I think, 150. And whatever you want to say about like the Verducci effect and whether or not big jumps in innings, I'm not getting into the science of it, but like, it's pretty clear he's in uncharted territory, and the Yankees probably are thinking like, we've already sort of like messed up we've sort of like really pushed him more than we would have ever expected to this year, and they're expecting to go make a deep playoff run. So asking him to come back on essentially 2 days rest is really it might be asking too much, frankly. I think that there's definitely some logic here as far as I'm concerned.
Now, the other side is interesting, too, because Trevor Bauer is starting in game one, not Corey Kluber and not Carlos Carrasco. It's Trevor Bauer first, Kluber second, Carrasco third, and then Josh Tomlin fourth. And that's surprising because Kluber is probably going to win the AL Cy Young this year. And it almost feels like a matter of, and there's reasoning behind this, and we'll explain, but it almost feels like a matter of getting a little too cute, right? Like, you have the best pitcher in the league. Throw him in the first game. I mean, this is a good Yankees team. I don't think you can look ahead to the next series, which just seems like maybe they're trying to do a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, to the Indians' credit, they're clearly, you know, have a thought process. You know, they're very like analytics oriented club, so I'm sure there's been a lot of, you know, real thought put into this decision, and they're going with it because they're really opening themselves up to a lot of criticism if this does not, you know, like, no one would criticize them if they started Kluber in game one and lost the series, but like if they lose game one and end up losing this, if they lose game one and Bauer pitches poorly and they lose the series, like, they're going to get second guessed for a long time.
And it's also very much about the schedule. You know, they want to keep Kluber on something like his regular rest. Well, all this needs is like one rain out and everything gets messed up. And it's not like, you know, rain in October in Cleveland or New York is a thing that can't happen. So we have some interesting stats here. And these are numbers versus the starting lineup that the Yankees had in the wild card game. And that's probably a good estimation of what they'll start in the division series. So Trevor Bauer against those guys, and all the numbers I'm about to say are obviously just from 2015 because we don't have the data from before that. 296 batting average against and a 306 expected batting average against. So what that says is he's basically earned his approximately 300 batting average against. The same thing for weighted on base. He's allowed a 361 weighted on base and a 373 expected weighted on base. So he's been slightly worse than an average pitcher. No real, you know, good luck or bad fortune in either direction. Now, Corey Kluber against those exact same guys, 109 plate appearances, a 179 batting average, and a 229 expected batting average. So maybe he's gotten a little fortunate, but it doesn't matter because even like his expected is still way better than Bauer. And what I found interesting as well was Carrasco actually hasn't been as great against these guys as I would have expected. 300 batting average, a 242 expected. So maybe he's gotten a little unfortunate. And as we talked about on our last show, we're really trying to get away from just the outcomes in these small samples because they don't really mean that much. But if we can get into the real, you know, quality of contact skill, hopefully that should tell us a little something more, because obviously it's an out if you crush a line drive to center field, but the pitcher didn't really do a great job there.
Yeah, and I did even a slightly deeper look at some of the numbers we had on how Yankees hitters performed against pitchers like Bauer, just to get a little bit of a larger sample size. So talking about, when I say like, I mean in terms of pitch velocity and movement. So the comps for Bauer in terms of pitch velocity and movement are Joe Biagini, Zach Wheeler, Tom Kohler, Justin Verlander, and Jeff Hoffman, just to give you a sense. These are the five like highest comps for him. The one that jumped out to me, Aaron Judge against the pitchers like Bauer in his career, an average exit velo of 108.4 miles per hour. Granted, we're talking about five batted balls here, but like, that's an average exit velocity. So there's an indication, again, small sample. This is performance, not results. He has absolutely barreled up the ball when he's faced these guys. Expected weighted on base of 618. So I'm very curious to see how Aaron Judge does against Trevor Bauer. On the flip side, Chase Headley and Brett Carter. Chase Headley, I'm not even sure, will be in the lineup. Expected weighted on base of 235 against the similar pitchers to Bauer. Brett Gardner, who will almost certainly be in the lineup, 275. But those are sort of the extremes on the from the Yankee lineup. But the Judge one obviously really jumped out to me.
Yeah, that's insane. You said expected weighted on base of 618. The league average is something like 320. So that's better. That's better. This seems to be the series that will mostly, of all of them, I think, really get into the bullpens, though. Right? I mean, they've got good starters on both sides, but I mean, these are the bullpen teams.
And that's sort of, I mean, the Indians are basically, I think they're sort of planning game one to be a bullpen game. That's what, I mean, they still kept Clevinger and
Salazar
on the roster essentially to be relievers. I mean, Dan Otero didn't make the
no.
didn't make their
they, Zach McAllister didn't make it. And who's the other guy? Oh, Nick Goody. That's what it was. Those three guys combined for, I think it was 176 strikeouts and 175 innings, and they didn't make the roster.
And I was talking about this with some of the other days, like looking at what the Yankees faced against the Twins, and I wasn't sure if there was any single pitcher on the Twins wildcard roster who would make the Indians playoff roster. When you consider role, like,
are you talking about just relievers?
And I mean, like,
you don't think like Jose Barrios would get in there somewhere?
He's the one guy who I think would, because even Irvin Santana wouldn't crack the rotation.
No.
And then you probably wouldn't even put him in the bullpen. So Berrios is the only guy I think would have a, be in the discussion of cracking. That's how good the Indians pitching staff is.
That is a wild thought, and I think you're right. So I guess we should do a prediction, right? We're here. Let's, we're talking about these teams. I mean, they're both really great teams. I feel like all four of these series are going to go five games because they're all – I say Cleveland 3, Yankees 2. I don't know. I don't have a good feeling about this one.
I kind of think – the Trevor Bauer thing is going to come back to bite them. I think the Yankees are going to win the series.
I think that the Yankees are very well positioned to go all the way, just based on their pitching staff and Aaron Judge hitting like Aaron Judge. So the other ALDS that's going to start is Houston and Boston. And I think this is the one that we're most interested in before the wild card games, because these are two really good teams. We saw them face each other at the end of the season. And I think the story of this series is going to be the ballparks in some way, because if you look at Houston, you know, a very short left field and right field. If you look at Boston, obviously the Green Monster. So there's the potential for some, I don't want to say cheap home runs, but, you know, you don't have to be Aaron Judge to hit home runs in these parks, right? So we got to, we have some numbers to support that. Now, for example, Minute Maid Park has the shortest average home run distance in baseball. The average home run is 400 feet. The longest is 417 in Colorado. In Houston, it's 391 feet. And I think we've talked about, like, Marwin Gonzalez home runs on this show a couple of times. If you hit it, like, right down the line in left field, you don't have to do much. We've also looked at softly hit home runs, and we've defined a hard hit ball as one that's 95 miles an hour or harder. So I believe like 96% of home runs this year in the majors were hard hit home runs. And if you look at the ballparks that had the most softly hit home runs, number one, Minute Maid Park with 23, and the second place is Cincinnati with 14. So that's a big deal, I think.
Yeah, it adds, because it sort of can give you, it gives you the opportunity of having some of these like unlikely, like hero moments where, you know, you have your Bucky Dent who just sort of just like, you know, cork one down the line and it's, oh, that's a home run. In fact, when you're facing a pitcher like Chris Sale, I'd argue that like, it's probably not a bad strategy to basically be like, I'm coming up here just trying to like hit a lazy fly to left field and over the
bat. I agree. Is your other option like you're going to string together five straight hits against Chris Sale? That seems unlikely. So I think you're totally right there. Four of the top 10 least likely home runs this year based on expected batting average came in either Boston or Houston. I thought that was, and we talked about some of these. Lorenzo Cain, I remember this one. He poked this one just around the pesky ball, projected 302 feet. That's a home run. The expected batting average in that was 0.019, and that's not expected home run percentage, that's batting average. So less than 2% of the time, a ball hit at 90 miles an hour, 39 degrees launch angle, becomes a hit, and he got a home run out of that because of the pesky pole.
But the thing is, at least the pesky pole juts out, so there's a very small window to get a cheap home run over there. Like,
right.
It juts out pretty straight out, whereas in Minute Maid, and what's interesting is it's not just the Crawford boxes. Right field is pretty short, too. So you basically have, it's a weird, because it's the dead center, it's actually pretty deep. But down the lines, it's got, almost got like a modern day Polo Grounds thing going on.
It's very weird because we're talking about like cheap home runs, but it also played very much like a pitcher's park this year. And so it's got a very bizarre effect going on. And you know, like the other ones on the top 10 list, Jake Marizic, George Springer, Josh Reddick, all in Houston, hit some very, let's say, favorable home runs for them. And then you also had an interesting stat here about, you know, not striking out so much. These teams had high numbers of contact. So the Astros had the highest rate of contact in baseball, 79% contact per swing. The Red Sox were third. So if you're not a fan of strikeouts, I don't know, maybe these are the teams to watch.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Astros, you know, finishing second in home runs and last in strikeouts is kind of remarkable in this day and age.
Yeah.
And I'm actually going to be in Fenway for games three and potentially four of this series, which I'm really looking forward to. You know, the David Price factor looms over this, sort of adds this whole, you know,
yeah,
level of intrigue.
Their bullpen's been really good.
Yeah, it's, you know, when they add Addison Reed's been very good for a couple of years now. Kimbrel.
Yeah, Carson Smith's back.
This might be the most interesting series to me.
Astros in four. I'm going to regret that, I think.
The Red Sox offense was surprisingly underwhelming this year. And obviously I'm going to say this, and then of course, you know, Xander Bogaerts's going to go and hit, you know, four home runs. But the offense just didn't really do enough for me to have the confidence against the Astros. I think the Astros will win the series.
Yeah, Red Sox had the fewest home runs in the American League. Betts didn't have the same kind of year. Pedroia is playing through pain. Bogaerts took a step back. So I agree with you on that. So let's move to the National League. This one, it comes in the Nationals. And I think the thing here is just rotation questions, right? Arrieta and Scherzer are both dealing with hamstring injuries. And at the moment, we still don't actually know when Scherzer is going to pitch. I assume it's game three. We already know Arrieta is going to be in game four. So for the Cubs, it's going to be Hendricks first, Lester, Quintana, and then Arrieta. For the Nationals, we assume Strasburg, then Gio Gonzalez, Scherzer probably third, and Roark fourth. We don't know that for sure yet, but that seems like a likely guess at this point.
Yeah, and the Scherzer thing is, I mean, that kind of could loom over the whole postseason, because, I mean, if it's lingering or he aggravates it, he's really good. They're just not the same team without him. And the fact that, like, I mean, it's pretty obviously unfortunate for them to have him sort of get this injury in his last, like, basically tune-up start. And now, you know, he didn't throw a bullpen when he was supposed to the other day. Now, see, they probably, by the time this, I think we're, Dusty Baker's meeting the media while we're recording
probably,
this podcast.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, it'll be moved. But it seemed pretty clear that Strasburg was going to start game one and that, you know, Scherzer might be compromised.
Yeah, and that's, it's not just Scherzer, too, because Bryce Harper, you know, missed all that time with a knee injury. And he made it back at the end of the year, the last week, but he only looked okay. You know, I think he had, like, 3 singles and 20 plate appearances or something like that. So this was supposed to be the year for the Nationals, and it just seems like, again, there's something happening.
I mean, certainly if you want to get into the whole narrative of the postseason, this is definitely kind of has, this could be Steven Strasburg's moment. You know, this year, looking at starting pitchers, lowest expected weighted on base allowed, Max Scherzer was first in the majors, 242. Behind him, Kluber, Sale, Kershaw, Paxton. Number 6, Strasburg. I feel like Strasburg actually pitched like the ace this year that we always waited for, but like it didn't really get the attention that maybe you would think otherwise.
It's tough when you're not the best pitcher on your own team, and it's tough when you have another pitcher who due to some surface level stats, people are like, I think people are pushing Gio Gonzalez now as an ace, and I like Gio Gonzalez. He's been a pretty competent starter for years, but I want to look at some of his numbers because I want to figure out, like, what is he? Now, last year, he had a 4.57 ERA. Not so great. This year, a 2.96 ERA. I mean, that's a pretty huge step forward. But when you look at the numbers behind it, I think this is interesting. Strikeout rate was identical, 22% in both years. He actually walked more this year, and the home run rate was identical. Now, to me, that doesn't seem like a guy who took a huge step forward. But we do have, you know, expected weighted on base, so that's a really good quality of contact stat. So last year, 317 expected on weighted on base. This year, 293. So I will buy that he did a better job of limiting contact. I don't know if I buy that he's now, like, you know, the third ace. I still look at him as, like, a pretty solid mid-rotation pitcher.
Yeah, I mean, he's his whole career he's sort of had, like, he's mixed in a couple of, like, elite-type years. I mean, he's gotten Cy Young votes before. He's not a guy that if you're the opposing team, you're not like, oh, we're facing Gio tonight. Where, like, Strasburg kind of has that aura when he's on. And I think that, you know, after the whole thing with the shutdown 5 years ago and the Nats still have never won a playoff series, that, like, Strasburg can sort of rewrite some of the narrative around him if he kind of pitches the way he's been pitching, and he can sort of, like, make up for maybe having a compromised Scherzer in the rotation. But, I mean, the Cubs kind of quietly, because of all the hype last year, and, like, you know, obviously winning the World Series, like, they kind of quietly were really dominant in the second half of the season. And second best record in the majors post break. They had the second most barrels in the National League this year, behind only the Dodgers. So this is a team that can really slug, and it's a fascinating matchup.
You're totally right about the Cubs narrative, because not only did they get off to a pretty disappointing start, Milwaukee hung around. So the Cubs didn't actually clinch this division until, like, the last week of the season. But yeah, in the second half, things really turned around. Like, Kyle Schwarber was brutal in the first half. He got sent back to the minors. He basically slugged like you expected him to slug for the last couple months of the season. Rizzo and Bryant were fine in the first half, and they both played a little better down the stretch. So this is actually a pretty dangerous lineup. And, you know, my question here is, when you go back to the game one starter for the Cubs, Kyle Hendricks, how do you feel about Kyle Hendricks? Because, right, you know, last year he had this phenomenal season. And this year, like all the other Cubs starters, velocity was down. We figured it was just because of a big, long season last year. First half, 4.09 ERA. 322 expected on weighted on base, but in the second half, a 219 ERA, 282 expected weighted on base. He actually looked really, really good.
He is like the opposite of everything of modern pitching, like the soft tossing righty.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist as a class of pitcher really anymore, because he's not just like, you know, it's not just he has a below average fastball. It's like a way below. He throws like 85.
He throws like 88 when he's good, and then when he was throwing 85 earlier in the season.
But still, you just don't see guys like that succeed. So he's to me, he's fascinating to watch. I mean, sometimes people throw out, oh, like, you know, Greg Maddux did it. But, like, Greg Maddux at his prime had an above-average fastball.
Absolutely.
You know, like, you know, for the time, you know, he was throwing 92, 93 when, like, starting pitchers were throwing 91, 92. Now it's like Hendricks is not anywhere close to an average fastball, at least in terms of velocity.
Yeah, I think the matchup I'm really most interested in this series is going to be Trey Turner versus Wilson Contreras and John Lester. Obviously, everybody in the world knows about John Lester's issues holding runners on, and Lester has actually had a pretty rough end of the season. He had an ERA over 5 for the last 2 months. But when we see, Trey Turner is obviously, he's got elite speed. We have him as the second fastest shortstop behind only Amed Rosario. I think he's in like the top 15 overall of every player. Stole 40-something bases despite missing 6 weeks.
He set the franchise record for stolen bases despite missing 6 weeks.
Right, which is really impressive. And then obviously Wilson Contreras has a cannon. Like, when I think of the best throwing arms behind the plate in baseball, I think of him and I think of Gary Sanchez, right? So I think when everybody was worried about, oh, David Ross is leaving, what's John Lester going to do? Well, Wilson Contreras was a pretty, capable replacement back there. So Lester is supposed to start game 2, and I expect that that's going to be a huge story there, is can the cannon of Contreras keep Turner from running wild? And I will say, I remember this from last year when the Dodgers played the Cubs. The Dodgers would take these huge leads on Lester, and then just not go. Like, if you're going to be 20 feet off the base, just go, my man. Like,
yeah, I mean, the same thing with Indians. We expect it to be such a, because the Indians actually, the 2016 Indians stole a fair amount of bases. So it was like, oh, the Indians are going to run on Lester, but they didn't really. And actually, when they tried, they got thrown out a few times. So it actually ended up being the head games of like John Lester versus base runners is always a fascinating subplot. And we'll see it in game 2, particularly if Turner gets on base.
And our final NLDS. Oh, wait, we have a prediction there. Cubs and Nationals. I guess the Scherzer thing throws a wrench in everything. I think I like the Nationals better, but I'm going to say Cubs in 5.
I think the Nationals are going to get off the schneid.
Okay.
win their first series.
Great. I think that's one we disagree on. And then Dodgers Diamondbacks is going to be the last one. And I think this is really interesting because I think the Diamondbacks are probably a better team than people give them credit for. I think the rotation has really been fantastic. But some of the decisions in the wildcard game have thrown the rotation into a little bit of an uncertain state because Zach Greinke started and then Robbie Ray came in after him. And Robbie Ray's been fantastic. So now it sounds like, unofficially, because we don't know yet, Taijuan Walker might start the first game. And when I was thinking about the rotation like a week ago, he was the guy I thought wasn't going to be in the rotation at all. I thought it would be Ray, Greinke, Zach Godley, and Patrick Corbin. And now it sounds like Walker's going to be starting game 1. So that's... they have a really good rotation, but now I'm a little less sure about it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the biggest concern with the D-backs, and they play the Dodgers tough this year, but like they're in terms of bullpen, they are the clear like weakest bullpen of the teams remaining. And when you're gonna try, if you're gonna pull starters early and be forced to pull starters early, like last night, even the wild card game, even when they used Robbie Ray, they still you got to their bullpen and just sort of like this is it.
Yeah.
Like,
and even Bradley gave up a couple of home runs.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the wild card for them is actually Jimmy Scherfey, who is another, like, he's a guy that could come in and maybe throw 70% breaking balls because he's got a ridiculous breaking ball. But there's not a lot there. And that's my concern with them is like when you're going to be asking them to get 4 innings from their bullpen. And I love Fernando Rodney more than almost anyone, but.
You know what my biggest surprise was in the wildcard game? Was that Rodney gave up 1 run. Because I expect Rodney to either give up 0 runs or like 9 runs. There's very rarely an in-between there.
So to me, that's sort of why they're really behind the 8 ball, because they're going to have to start their third best starter in game 1. And you could argue that, Walker, whomever is even in their third best starter. So not having probably Greinke, or maybe the bring Ray back for game 2.
I think Ray probably game 2, Greinke game 3. You might argue that the biggest winner of the wild card game was actually the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Because this hurt the biggest strength of the Diamondbacks. And the Dodgers have some rotation questions too. Kershaw is going to start game 1. And I think for the rest of time, we're going to hear about, what's Kershaw's deal in the postseason, some of which is valid and some of which is not. Rich Hill game 2, most likely. Darvish game 3. And then we don't know yet about Alex Wood or potentially Hyunjin Ryu in game 4. But these are obviously, the Dodgers have Kershaw, and then they've also got a ton of different guys who are valuable in different ways. Kenta Maeda might come out of the bullpen. So I think that's interesting. The Dodgers actually have 3 of the top 6 left-handed starters in baseball based on expected weighted on base. Sale number 1, then Kershaw, then Paxton, Hill, Keuchel, Wood. Now, I actually kind of like Wood better as a reliever. His velocity dropped kind of a lot. Like, he's not a guy I want to see going 5 or 6. I guess I don't care if he starts or not. He's the guy you want facing 10 batters,
yeah,
right? And then you get him out of there. And the Dodgers have a lot of guys like that. You know, not Kershaw, obviously, but I feel like they are going to be another team that is going to patch together, you know, eight or nine batters at a time, because I trust Kenley Jansen. He's fantastic. Brandon Morrow had a great year. And then after that, even in the Dodgers bullpen, it's like, do you trust Tony Watson, Cingrani, Pedro Baez? I mean,
well, that's why, I mean, with, you know, we talked, you know, the question is who's going to be the first pitcher, starting pitcher of the playoffs to face a batter a third time? Because right. We have not had it yet.
0 for 4. Not by
And I think, you know, Kershaw is obviously one of the few guys you really trust to do it on a consistent basis. And if, you know, if you're Dave Roberts, you're basically hoping, like, even if Kershaw gives me six, it saves me for game two. I basically have my entire, not just bullpen, entire pitching staff available for game two. Because, you know, like, put Kershaw on my game three starter aside. It's like, I can pitch anyone on my staff in game two. And then you can talk about the situation you had where it's like, okay, maybe Alex Wood pitches to 10 batters. Rich Hill pitches to 10 batters. You don't have to worry about, you know, starter relievers as much. You know, that's the situation. That's why you need, where the advantage of having someone like Kershaw as much as anything is like, he frees up your pitcher usage in game two, because that game two is like the one you have the back-to-back game there. You know, then you get the off day, and that's where the playoff bullpen management, you know, is so different from the regular season, because you get all those extra off days. But Kershaw gives you length in game one. That really frees you up in game two to really kind of play matchups and have a really short leash.
Yeah, I looked at Kershaw versus the wild card Diamondbacks starting lineup, you know, assuming it would be it won't be the same because of lefty-righties, but similar. And, you know, 48 plate appearances, 156 batting average, 147 expected batting average. So he's been really good, and he's earned all of it. I also looked at Greinke versus what a potential Dodgers lineup could be. So, you know, Bellinger, Grandel, Puig, et cetera. 116 plate appearances, 260 batting average, but a 306 expected batting average, which I think is interesting. You know, Puig has only had a 167 average against him, but a 348 expected batting average. I looked it up. He had some pretty hard hit sack flies. And Seager against Greinke, 545 batting average, 551 expected batting average. So he has earned pretty much all of that. And so that'll be pretty interesting. But I do think, I don't want to sell the Diamondbacks short. And some of these guys, like Zach Godley, came out of nowhere and he was fantastic. Patrick Corbin had a pretty rough first half, but very much better in the second half, although the Dodgers have a lot of righty hitters too. So I'm not sure what they're actually going to do with that fourth spot, but I do like Zach Godley better than most, I think.
Yeah, to me, the interesting subplot here is the Diamondbacks have done a really good job of working the corners as a staff. And I think probably some of this credit has to go to Jeff Mathis. I mean, they basically brought in Jeff Mathis because he's got a great reputation as a framer. The numbers say he's great as a framer. He's not a good hitter, but the fact that he played every day on a team that he was a starting catcher on a team that won, like, what, 93 games or
something like that, yeah,
tells you he's doing something right and is adding value. And the Diamondbacks had the highest, we're going to get really granular here because we went on pitches on the zone here, the highest whiff per swing rate on non-borderline breaking balls below the zone by team. So they got whiffs out of the zone. So they get pitches on the corners, they get swings out of the zone, and the Dodgers, on the flip side, had the second overall lowest overall swing rate and the lowest swing rate on out of zone pitches.
Wait, that first one. Highest whiff per swing rate on non-borderline breaking balls below the zone. What is the StatCast podcast for if not to get totally granular?
So basically they're getting chases on breaking balls out of the zone, and the Dodgers are basically the best team at not swinging at such pitches. And going back to what I was saying before about their bullpen, it's really about the Dodgers wearing out the Diamondback starters and basically getting to that bullpen, you know, in the fourth or fifth inning. Because that's the biggest – no team has a bigger gap between its starting pitchers and its bullpen than the Diamondbacks. And I'm not sure it's close. Like, of the teams in the playoffs, like, they've got a really good starting pitching staff and the weakest bullpen. So, like, the gap there is so enormous.
I think you're right. Yeah, and we might have said that about Washington earlier, but they added Doolittle, they added Madsen, they added Kinsler. They've actually been pretty good in the second half. I think you're absolutely right. If there's if you're going to pick a weakness for every team, I think for the Diamondbacks, it's easily the bullpen.
And for that reason, this is the one series I feel fairly confident about. In my pick, the rest of the series, I'm like, I don't know who's going to win. I feel somewhat confident the Dodgers are going to win the series for that reason.
Dodgers in four?
I don't really like to pick games, but sure, four.
So we've agreed on three of these four series then.
Wait, we agreed. We both had the Dodgers.
Yeah, we both had the Astros.
Okay, and I took the Nats, and you took the Cubs.
And we both had Cleveland.
No, you picked the Yankees.
I picked Cleveland. Okay, great. Well, that's good. I like to disagree with you sometimes. So that is our show for this week. This is the MLB.com StatCast podcast. We'll check back next week to see how our predictions are doing. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you then.